All right, tonight's our 30th senior fellowship class of the year so far. We're doing good. And we are dealing with a topic which, unless you're living underneath a rock, is probably the most spoken about and meaningful issue that not only that America is grappling with. And that, of course, is the issue of even the way I express it is already, if I say, is it police brutality? Is it police violence? Is it police murder? In other words, even whatever word I say is itself is a political thing. So I'll just say in a more generic term, we'll get into the tragic events. Now, we're going to focus on one case, the case that happened last Friday night, the case of Rayshard Brooks in Atlanta. We're going to watch a video. It's not for the lighthearted. Okay, so I'm just giving you a heads up if you want to look. You know, it's not, I mean, you're watching a murder of somebody. It's not, it's not easy. So, and the reason why I'm discussing that, obviously I'm not an expert in issues of law enforcement and policing. I want to use an opportunity for us to explore Judaism's vision of the interaction between law enforcement and the legal and the judicial branch, the police and the judges, how those are supposed to work together. That's so we can understand from our tradition what we view as, and some of the problems that we are going to discuss that'll come out tonight are in a certain sense foreshadowed or being solved within the system of mitzvot. That's our goal for tonight. But I want to get into some of let's get into some of the details here of the case itself. So if you're not up on all the cases and they're sort of like blending into one, this video I felt did a nice job, and then we'll discuss it. And we're blessed to have Simone, who, in addition to being a fine member of the senior fellowship, literally, this is what she does day and night, writes articles for the Marshall Project. She's dealing with issues of all aspects about law enforcement, policing, police reform, etc. So we have somebody who actually knows what they're talking about. It's good to have that as part of our class. So I'm happy that she's able to come. And it's going to be an interesting conversation. You know, we're just
going to
That's it. We're just going to let it go. And we're in a safe space here, so you know, we don't have to be you know, as long as you're just cuff a dick and prevent, you know, we'll have meaningful conversations about the issue that is gripping America. If you would call this is the issue, really, in a certain sense, which is the battle for the soul of America. And how we deal with this topic is something which is of deep significance. All right. So I'm going to start with a video, obviously. Let's get to it. I'm going to do the old share screen. And here we go. This will bring you up to date in 3 minutes or less. Here we go.
The march today in Atlanta in response to the weekend shooting of Rayshard Brooks, a black man who'd fallen asleep in his car at a Wendy's. Brooks died after being shot twice in the back by police. The coroner has ruled it a homicide. The Atlanta mayor says she doesn't think deadly force was justified. And a local minister says, we are sick and tired of being sick and tired. Stephen Fabian has a moment-by-moment analysis of what happened.
Tears and raw emotion as distraught relatives of a black man shot dead by cops speak out today. Law enforcement experts are divided over the fatal shooting of 27-year-old Rayshard Brooks in Atlanta, with one expert calling it lawful but awful. Two experts analyzed the disturbing video for Inside Edition, former New York City Police Commissioner Bernie Carrick and former LAPD Sergeant Cheryl Dorsey.
The use of deadly force in this case, as I saw it, was justified.
There was no need for deadly force.
Police were called because Brooks was asleep at the wheel in a Wendy's drive-thru line in Atlanta.
You're blocking traffic here. You were sleeping when I walked up here.
Brooks failed the breathalyzer test, then this happened.
That's why you're back away.
Brooks battles with the two officers and grabs a taser.
Stop fighting! You're gonna get tased!
He wriggles free and is tased as he runs away. Then he points a taser at one of the cops and is shot twice. A third bullet struck a car with children inside. Did this officer need to fire on a man who was running away, running in the opposite direction?
If that suspect hit that officer with the taser and incapacitated him, he could be disarmed. He could take his personal sidearm, his firearm.
But former LAPD Sergeant Dorsey says she would not have used deadly force.
I know what police officers do when you have a suspect get away or you lose your personal equipment. You will be teased for years and years to come. That officer wasn't going to have that happen, and that's why he did what he did.
An autopsy shows Brooks was shot twice in the back and ruled his death a homicide. President Trump spoke about the incident today.
Certainly, it was very disturbing.
The officer who fired the fatal shots, Garrett Rolfe, has been fired, and there are demands for him to be charged with murder. Brooks' widow, Tamika, mother of their four children, spoke out today.
I can never get my husband back. I can never get my best friend. I can never tell my daughter, oh, he's coming to take you skating or swimming lessons.
Other family members at the emotionally charged press conference became distraught. The shooting comes as America is still reeling from 3 weeks of protests over the death of George Floyd, and it is giving fresh impetus to demands for racial justice.
The death of another black man at the hands of a police officer.
The Wendy's where the shooting occurred was torched over the weekend. Police are looking for a mystery white woman caught on camera appearing to set the fire.
Look at a white girl trying to burn down a Wendy's. This wasn't us.
Okay. All right, so let's start with the beginning, which is, let's just make sure everybody knows the facts of what occurred. All right, just go back and we'll make sure play by play. What happened first? I don't know if you guys follow the chronology. You want to make sure it's very important to get the order of the facts clear. What happened first?
He was stopped because he was sleeping in his car through a drive-thru. So that's the first encounter.
Right. Well, so first of all, why the cops called? Because he as later found out he was drunk. He stopped his car in the middle of the drive-thru lane. In other words, there's a drive-thru lane to pick up food in Wendy's, and he just drove and he put in the middle. And that's what the call came in from the Wendy's employee, that the guy basically fell asleep, and therefore that was inconveniencing people because they could not drive through and pick up their food. Okay, that was the initial point. All right, then what happened?
Then the breathalyzer.
No. Yeah,
a couple. Doesn't show the entire video. I just want to make this point that the whole encounter was 41 minutes.
Yes.
And in that 41 minutes, the cops were very calm talking to the gentleman. They knocked on the window. He came out. He took a sobriety test. So it was actually a very de-escalated event. And only in the last 60 seconds did it turn deadly, which is not an Inside Edition tape. So, I mean, speaking of law enforcement types, which I've done this whole entire week, this is a very... I guess gray area shooting because it escalated literally within seconds. It wasn't like a tense standoff. The guy was complying. He was even cracking jokes on the body camera video, and he ran away. Which the Inside Edition video doesn't show. I actually saw the body camera video. He's handcuffed. There's a struggle. He grabs the cop's taser, runs a couple of feet. The cop who shot and killed him is not the cop who had his taser stolen. It's his partner.
Excellent.
Which I can keep going. So right. That's why it's a very controversial shooting.
Right. Now, as Simone pointed out, everything was going smoothly. Now, another question that's raised by police experts is why does the guy, even for DUI, does the guy need to be handcuffed and arrested? You know, that's another question that's debated. But anyways, the key element is that When he started, you saw, which was captured by the Inside Edition footage, is when they start to handcuff him, that's when Rayshard start to resist and fight being arrested in that manner. And he fought, grabbed the taser, and was running away from the two cops, And now, even though he's going to point the taser back, the guy shot him. Now, 2 hours ago, the cop who shot him was fired and I believe arrested, and he's going to be charged with counts. Now, Simone, if I may put you on the spot, when cops are arrested and put on trial for an unlawful use of force, which results even in cases of the death or murder of, how frequently do they get? Put into jail, or do any time for that? What's the rate of acquitting?
No. So cops are generally not criminally convicted. I think it's only 1% after a fatal shooting actually are criminally convicted. Justice is really served in the civil courts, which is a whole other conversation. What's very important about this case, I think, and I've been covering law enforcement and killings for a very long time. Number one, from a law enforcement perspective, if someone takes a weapon from a cop and points that weapon at a cop before this political climate, we wouldn't even be talking about this. This is not, like, the George Floyd case was a different story. This is, I think, a political climate type of an issue, not so much the facts. Secondly, he's charged, which is also very important, which never happens in policing. He was charged today with felony murder. Felony murder, for the lawyers on the call, is when you help, when you are, complicit in the execution of someone's death. Most cases, a cop may get charged with manslaughter. They might get charged. We don't have in New York, but in Minneapolis, that cop was charged with murder 2, which originally was charged with murder 3, but whatever. They rarely get charged with felony murder. And I actually know that prosecutor. I've done stories in Atlanta. He's, I would say, very sensational and does a lot of things for attention. And I also want to note in the Atlanta case that the mayor is on the short list for Biden's vice president pick. She's one of 6 women selected. So when I talk about the Atlanta case, we have to really wrap up all the politics. Policing is very much a political issue right now. So very curious, if this happened a month ago, would we be talking about this today?
That's an excellent point. So, among the, there are 3 schools of thought about the nature of this killing. Was it justified and proper, which we saw that former New York City Police Chief Carrick said? They quoted a third professor, lawful but awful, or legal?
Can I ask a question, actually, to
Simone? Yes, Daphne, also a lawyer.
This is a question that I have. So, a taser, I know the taser was introduced because it was a non-lethal way to detain someone. Without shooting them, if they were a threat, you would tase them, they would be debilitated, and then you could arrest them. It has led to deaths. People have died from being tased. Does it make a difference, the fact that he was just holding a taser, which is technically not like a deadly weapon at that point, even though he was being threatened? And what did escalate at the very last minute, you know, it was a very calm encounter in the beginning. It wasn't like a straight up hostile encounter from the start. And it's not as though the guy was, I just know with lethal force cases, and from the Supreme Court, you can use it if there is like a threat, like a real threat of physical safety. That's why the whole "if you loot, you're going to shoot" thing was so horrible, because it's just like goes against every Supreme Court case on this issue. But does it make a difference that it was a taser? I mean,
no,
could you argue that it was not a lethal force?
Well, I think a good defense attorney will argue that. A good defense attorney will also argue he was shot in the back. However, coming from the policing side, he stole a cop's taser and fired it. From the video, I don't know if Inside Edition captured this, but the body cam video shows the cord of the taser, like, nearly missing the cop. The cop dodges the cord of the taser. So if he was hit, he would have been tased, right?
Right.
So from a legal law enforcement point of view, if a suspect, I've covered cases where cop shot and killed someone for holding one of those knives. They're not even knives, that open up like the envelope opener thing. I mean, cops shoot and kill people all the time for holding nonsense. So stealing a cop's taser, then firing the taser at the cop. Again, I strongly believe, because of this political environment, this is big national news, and maybe I'm jaded, and, you know, I'm not a lawyer, I'm not a judge, so what do I know? but this is not like George Floyd is like a, excuse my language, a fucked up case. Like they choked the guy and killed him. This is like it's a very gray.
Very gray. So you're going at. You're siding toward justified and proper, or lawful or but awful. Simone, if I could put you on the spot, you're gonna go with
lawful but awful.
Okay.
It is definite. It's right, but again, I'm not the prosecutor in Atlanta, so you would disagree with me.
Right. Correct. So it's being that.
But also, prosecutors are generally elected officials, so there's that piece.
So you see already there's the challenge of police dealing with escalating and dangerous situations where you have to make decisions in very, you know, very challenging. And then we have the political climate, which of course, where basically George Floyd was basically murdered. Just a vicious murder. Hard to argue a justification for that. And then this coming out of that in an environment where this everybody's enraged about these inequalities and these injustices. Okay, so let me ask you a question to everybody else. Open up everybody else. What makes these cases so difficult for the police when you're in the real time? You're a police officer. You and your partner go down to deal with a situation. What makes these decisions so challenging? I'm going to call upon some people I have not heard from tonight. All right, so Max Sterling. Okay, you're still on mute. Now you turned off your volume. Now you turned off your. I'll get back to Max. We don't have your. Okay, Suzanne, you were a parole officer. We got the entire. I don't know if people know that Suzanne was a parole officer. Most unlikely person you would imagine is a parole officer, Suzanne Berkeley. All right, so we got every part of the. We got Laura. We have Stephanie, who's in that. She was an elected official. We got it. We got the whole. We got the Garth Mishpacha here. All right, so. You saw the video, you see many such videos. What makes these case scenarios so challenging for the police?
So, you know, before I became a therapist, I was pretty liberal, but I only dealt with convicted felons. And I never knew. I was pretty chill, I think it's because I was young and stupid, and I was like, yeah, and I didn't carry a weapon. But you don't know what a person's going to do. And when I had an arrest warrant, I had people running, breaking through doors. I was going to their home. And you don't know what they're going to do and put your safety at risk. And to me, a friend yelled at me when she said, you know, I said, there are good cops, there are bad cops. It wasn't for me about a race of a person. I knew what their crimes were, and a cop doesn't know what they're walking into, and you just don't know what you're walking into. And of course I saw racist cops. Of course I did. So I read police reports and I was like, how was this person arrested? And so, and like I said, there's good and bad in everything, but, you just don't know what you're walking into, and people are unpredictable. And the thought of some people going to jail, because a lot of them know there's a warrant and this is the end of the line for them, they're going to do whatever they can try to do to not go that way.
Okay, so basically, to step into the shoes of a police officer, you're walking into situations which can be very explosive, where your personal safety can be compromised, or you could be killed, you could be hurt, whatever. And people could be drunk, people could be high, people could be, you know, whatever could going on. And you're walking into, now obviously they're supposed to be trained to be able to de-escalate situations and manage it properly. But again, if a guy puts a taser in your face or shoots a taser, You know, as obviously his defense lawyer will argue, he was his personal safety was at risk, and therefore he shot. Now, you know, should he have thought him three times, or should have shot him in the, you know, the legs? You know, whatever. These all kinds of so these situations are very difficult because it requires split second decisions in the most heated of emotions, which makes. In our own personal lives, we have to sometimes we are make to make very important decisions with very little time for reflection. Mistakes happen. That's when you're going to make a mistake.
Can I just add about shooting in the leg? Cops, once they pull out their gun, are trained to shoot center mass. So that's another misconception in the public. Once a cop pulls out that gun, pulls that trigger, you are killing. You're not supposed to disarm them, not with your gun. And I think the public doesn't really know that.
I did not know that.
You shoot center mass. That's the whole point of pulling out your gun. Yeah. Most people don't. I'm the policing nerd. I've been writing about this for a long time. So people don't know that. So that's from people very critical of what happened in Atlanta, that once that cop pulled out that gun, he's killing that guy. And, like, is that fair to kill a guy who was arrested for DUI? There's a Supreme Court case that Daphne will know about. Daphne, what's the Supreme Court case about shooting a fleeing felon? I forgot the name of the case.
I don't know the name, but I know Supreme you Court can't shoot someone fleeing.
Daphne, share with
them. You can't if they're a felon. If they're a fleeing felon, you can shoot them. This guy was not a fleeing felon. He was a fleeing drunk.
Right.
Yes.
Okay. So, the...
You mean if they're fleeing from the scene of, like, a violent crime, or they had a record, like a felony?
Yes, the cop is allowed to shoot them. No, if they're fleeing the scene from committing a felony, the Supreme Court has held that a cop can shoot them, even in the back.
Yes, because,
is a very popular...
Because theoretically, they could be a... Which should be turned out, because theoretically, the theory is, let's say you're fleeing a violent crime, like a burglary is considered a violent crime because you're breaking and entering, and you could have a weapon... You can go and cause more. You can cause violence elsewhere. So then, lethal force is lawful in those terms in that decision. Yeah, that maybe is due for review. I don't know, but I have a question about justice when it comes to this case. So I agree. This is lawful, but awful as an attorney. This guy, the likelihood of the officer being convicted is like slim to none. it really is because. A lot of traffic stops, you know, that escalate, you know, really cops just stop people for not, like, doing a turn signal or, you know, stupid things. This man was stopped because he was sleeping, and it escalated thereafter. So, you know, it really started very lawful, and it escalated, like, in the last minute, after 41 minutes, which is pretty important in terms of, like, this is not a trigger-happy cop.
Right.
But my question is, how do you look at this case without, like, thinking of, like, the centuries of, like, injustice in America. Like, okay, let's say this case was three white women, two white female cops, and the white female was the person sleeping in the car. Would it be news? I mean, you know, you have to look at it in a way that's very surgical, and these are the facts, and we have to take emotion out of it, and, you know, have a trial just based on, like the law as applied to the facts. But at the same time, like, you can't take away the context, which is, like, I don't know, like, 400 years of horrible injustice, and the last 50, like, just horrible, almost to the level of state-sanctioned, you know, police and criminal procedure that's been... So how do you do that? Like, what is justice in this case?
I think that's a good point. Well, I just want to say that the Atlanta... Daphne, who's a good friend of mine, knows I was in Atlanta this summer doing a story about federal task forces, which Atlanta backed out of, and the lead case of that story was a schizophrenic man shot and killed by U.S. Marshals, but also Atlanta cop shot and killed this guy in his own home. He was a schizophrenic, long story, whatever. That case is still pending. Atlanta still has dozens of open cases that this prosecutor has not ruled on going years back. Cases way more fucked up than this one. So a lot of people think he's just doing this for politics to help the mayor who's on Joe Biden's shortlist. Is that right or wrong? I don't know. It's almost like he's being hypocritical because there's so many other cases he has not prosecuted involving cops who've done a lot crazier shit.
A lot.
No, so
he has charges in like 5 days. That never happened.
Right. So that. So by the way, that is
for
not
a cop to get convicted.
Or this is all not this. And again, all this information is not known to us because it's not in the regular media. whether it be the New York Times, Wall Street Journal, etc. But other than the fact that they rushing to a conviction and rushing a charging this officer, firing him, etc., it's clearly due to the general what's happening in America. I want to pivot now, because clearly the problem is you have these, as Suzanne pointed out, and Simone and Daphne pointed out, you have these officers going into these situations, which by definition are dangerous, you know, and even though they're following procedure, it can escalate in a very rapid way, like literally in less than a second, and you have to make a very thoughtful decision, and as Simone educated us, if the gun's coming out, they're going center mass, means they're shooting the guy in the center of his body, and that's to kill. So these are very challenging decisions. So this, by the way, what I'm going to share with you is an insight which you would not know about how the Jewish concept of both the judicial system and the law enforcement system work together. So I'm going to go to share screen, so we're going to learn a little bit about that, which in a certain sense is dealing to address this very, very problem that we're talking today, which you would not know about. So here we go. Okay, let's begin. So I'll have somebody read. This is the mitzvah of reporting. This is in Devarim, chapter 16. Who would like to read? Stephanie, b'vakasha.
Judges and justice, appoint yourselves judges and police for your tribes in all your settlements that God, your Lord, is giving you, and make sure that they administer honest judgment for the people. Do not bend justice, and do not give special consideration to anyone. Do not take bribes, since bribery makes the wise blind and perverts the words of the righteous. Pursue perfect honesty so that you will live and occupy the land that God your Lord is giving you.
All right, so that those, if you mean, clearly there's a mitzvah here, we're going to get into it, of a setting up a judicial system which has two components, which is the judges who will adjudicate justice, we'll get into that, and the police. And there's rules about justice and not take bribes. And all these things, all this biblical concepts is also part of the fabric of every judicial system in a world. Every civilized country has an institution of judges and police. Now, again, some are corrupt, and they have it officially on the books not to take bribes and to not give anybody preferential thing, even though it does occur, which we're dealing, of course, issues of systemic racism, etc., and the ideal of pursuing perfect honesty in order that you'll live in the land. So basically, the Torah is very clear that success in the land, a successful society, needs proper and effective justice and law enforcement. Without that, you're not going to be successful. Okay? That's number one. Let's go on. Let's go to the mitzvah. This is from the Rambam. Shrink the mitzvah down. Here we go. All right, let's have somebody. Who else wants to read? Any volunteers? All right, Max, Bavakashel, let's see if you got it.
It is a positive scriptural commandment to appoint judges and enforcement officers in every city and in every region. As Deuteronomy 16:18 states, appoint judges and enforcement officers in all your gates. Judges, shoftim, refers to established magistrates whose attendance in fixed court before whom the litigants appear. Enforcement officers / police, shochim, refer to those equipped with a club and a lash who stand before the judge and together patrol the marketplaces and the streets to inspect the stores and to regulate the prices and the measures of the scales. They inflict corporal punishment on all offenders. Their deeds are controlled entirely by the judges. Whenever a person is seen misbehaving, they are brought to the court to be judged according to his wickedness.
Okay. Now, this is the Chiddush here. The Chiddush is, what is unusual? There are two kinds of, the Rambam says there are two kinds of judges. Who can identify the two kinds of judges?
So, it seems like there's the shoftim and the shotrim, right?
Well, the shoftim are the judges and the shotrim are the police. But there are two kinds. They're two, but the judges, the shoftim, have two roles.
So it seems like there's like walking about judges and like sitting in place judges.
Correct. So there are judges that are in the courthouse that are there to adjudicate the cases. And when the police do their patrols, they are accompanied by a judge. And they're not allowed, the police cannot administer any kind of corporal punishment unless what?
A judge approves.
Now, what? That's obviously a very labor-intensive thing. What problem is that there to solve?
Well, it seems like they're
police abuse has to fit according to the law.
Well, but these guys are going
like,
around.
It's the law. That's why cops get in trouble right now. But I just want to say that's why cops get in trouble right now because they're abusing their power. Right? There's the whole color law statute. It's abusing your power in the federal government. So if we had judges out with the cops, they could be like, "Hey, you have authorization. You using force is justified. Go shoot that guy." That'd be great.
This is a very different kind of policing, though, because what these guys are firstly worried about are corrupt, like, business practices. They're looking for, like, cheats in the marketplace who are skewing their scale. So it's like a consumer protection agency.
So like the SEC.
Right, well, so obviously, so, right,
it's
but
like a zoning issue. Like,
so let me clarify, in other words, because the Rambam was talking about the principal problem in the Jewish community, at least from the perspective of the Talmud, was basically Jews. I know this is going to be shocking. Hold on to your seats. Jews ripping off other Jews in business.
That be our biggest problem.
No, because in the Jewish community, that was the problem. They did have corporal punishment. Well, there is a death penalty also in Judaism as well. Rarely adjudicated because of all the checks and balances. But I want to make the key point here. The Rambam brings the example of the principal issue. First of all, number one, there's an idea of community policing. In other words, I want you guys to visualize a different world here for a moment. Okay? Well, before I go back, before I get to that, I want to ask a question to somebody on the Simone who knows the answer. But let's see if somebody else knows the answer. What is the principle of community policing in America? There's a concept of community policing. Who could share what that is?
So the idea is that there's a police officer who ideally also lives within the community, but that they patrol and participate in a particular neighborhood so that they are viewed as part of the neighborhood and it's not an outside person coming in. And so they go to civic association meetings and they go to all these different things so that it is part of your community that is being.
What is the hope and aspiration of community policing hoping to accomplish?
Trust between the police and the people that...
But can I just say that community policing is a lot broader than that? It's simply defined, it started in the 70s, as building trust within communities, especially communities of color. Neighborhood policing, which you're talking about, Stephanie, is one of them. You also have ideas of, like, PAL, the Police Athletic League, having cops having barbecues. It's just showing people that cops are humans, too. And, like, let's treat each other with respect. And if the human treats the cop with respect and the cop treats the human with respect, it helps cops, too, because then it allows cops to get people to come forward and report crimes, to be witnesses in cases. So it's a whole mindset of building trust, like a two-way trust channel.
Exactly. Now, so here, visualize this. Now, who in Judaism, who is the Dayan, the judge? Who is that guy?
It's the council, right?
Sanhedrin, is that what you're thinking?
Right, Sanhedrin, of course, is the Supreme Court, which is in Jerusalem, right?
So Well, so is it a base theme like we know?
A base theme, right. A person there's a whole court system. The smallest court that can deal with monetary issues is a court of three judges. A judge that can deal with corporal issues is what they call a Sanhedrin Kitana, a small, large court of 23 judges. And of course, the Supreme Court has 71 judges. But again, this is not a paid position. In other words, what does the Dayan do in general?
Is he just a person?
Well, yeah, he's a person, yes. But in order to be a Dayan, let me provide in a modern context. In Israel, there's a double legal system. There's the secular Israeli system, and there's the Beis Din system. If you want to become a Dayan, it requires the first level smicha, which takes about, let's say 5 years. And then to do all the material and get tested to be a Dayan, guess how many years in the state of Israel to pass the test to be a Dayan? Guess, throw me at a number.
I assume it's like another PhD equivalent.
Seven is correct, Stephanie. Seven is correct.
That was Simone.
Simone, correct.
Yeah, I said.
7 years. So basically, the Dayan in your Jewish community is basically like the head rabbi guy. And most of the time, he's not dealing with cases. What is he mostly doing? What do rabbi guys tend to do?
Raising money for the synagogue.
Well, teaching and learning. So the Dayan that is walking with the shoter, with the police officer who has the equipment, the strap and the club. They didn't have guns then, but whatever. He was your rabbi that you learned from, so he's walking through the community. And what Simone mentioned before is the idea that they're dealing with, like, there's two levels of mind. The problem in police, part of the problem of America's police violence is that they are confronted by very quick legal problems that it requires a mind of a different order to have. Do you understand what I'm saying? Yes, they are trained. They go to a police academy. They train. But oftentimes, but in Judaism, they're not given they're not trusting the police officer. If you're going to start to inflict violence or punish people on the spot, they're not going to trust that activity to that level of mind. Do you understand what I'm saying? You need to have somebody who's well-equipped to do that. First of all, whose nature is to be centered and thoughtful and reflective and not to be moved by emotions. Okay? Doesn't mean he can't be emotional, but a judge is by definition in America is typically going to be a very sober, thoughtful character by and large. Okay? So imagine that you had judges in the patrol. Okay? Now again, how would that work practically in America? But we're talking about a different society, but this problem is the same. Because if you're going to let the guy go through the streets and the marketplace with weaponry, and somebody's going to tick him off, what is he going to do? He's going to beat people up who are not justified to be beat up. That's just the net. And which kind of guy goes into policing? A timid, mellow person, or a person who, shall we say, kind of likes having guns and kind of likes giving people a smack? There's a person, in other words, typically a person who wants to be going to the library sciences is not a person who wants to be an officer of a police force. Those are different kind of people. So people who like to be, it's very common to be ex-military, it's in a person who is more on the aggressive side, not going to be your cerebral, thoughtful, reflective intellect, by and large. Allow me to make some generalizations here. So the terrorist says, "We got it." Terrorist says, "We're gonna have our muscle guy, the chauteur, who's going to be, you know, who when there has to be some, shall we say, a little bit of force, a little bit of attitude adjustment, when somebody's got to be taken down, you need somebody got to be take the guy down." And you have basically the, you know, like the Rabbi Plus guy, the Dayan, the Shofet, who's there to provide. He's not allowed to do anything unless the Shoter, the Shofet, says yes. Okay? So, now, people might also argue, you know, there's a big move toward defunding the police, which, you know, it's to me, that's like, I mean, sounds insane. You know, if you have doctors involved in a medical malpractice, you're not going to say, let's take money away from medical schools. I mean, just because people make mistakes does not mean that, you know, the money could be probably maybe used in a more wise fashion. You know, but that, you know, that seems very remote for me to be solving the problem. Now, it's interesting, the Torah, I'm going to show you the next halacha the Ram talks about in the Sefer HaMitzvot, talks about the requirement. Person is like, you know, why do we need all, maybe we have too much police. There's a man, you know. So I want to share a little Rambam with you guys and see how the Rambam weighs in on that. All right, Shana Bavakasha, read this one, Establishing the Judicial System. Share us an insight there.
The 176th mitzvah is that we are commanded to appoint judges to implement the Torah's commands, to force those who have turned away from the path of truth to return to it, to command the performance of good and the avoidance of bad, and to carry out the punishment of transgressors, so that the positive commandments of the Torah and their prohibitions should not be dependent on the desire of every individual.
Right. That line, that last line of the Rambam, that observance of the Torah, which of course half the Torah is the civil law that we're dealing with tonight, insofar as not damaging property, treating people with respect, obviously not, God forbid, killing people, hurting people, whatever, but not allowing the system of law of mitzvot to be dependent on the desire of every individual. That cannot be. In other words, you can't just think, why don't we all just be nice? No. There has to be a judicial system, A. There needs to be law enforcement, B. Because you cannot require people to, in a certain sense, self-police. That's not realistic. Even in a terrorist society. Now, obviously, depending on the level of sophistication and refinement and self-actualization, what are your problems going to be? As Max pointed out earlier, the main problem in the Jewish community, the Rambam sort of like used to exemplify, was basically people stealing from people in the marketplace. You know what I mean? You know. That seems to be the Jews have not heretofore been known to be a people who's generally involved with on a personal level on violent crime. By and large, there are exceptions. There were Jews that were involved in the mob that also killed people. So we're not saying we're perfect, but fundamentally, depending on the level of the society, what your problems of policing are going to be are going to differ. Okay, so I guess the question I want to share, I want to open up back to you guys is what, you know, based upon this perspective, and again, we're in America, what reforms could be made to improve the police violence situation or issues? What do you guys say? Just let's open up. What could be done?
So, one of the...
I just want to say,
Go ahead. One at a time.
I just wanted to say, I do a, like, this question comes up a lot in media interviews that I have to do now, and I want people to know, I think this is really great, because policing has a dearth of educated people, and in most departments, you need a GED or high school. New York City, Chicago, other big cities, you need at least a two-year degree. Philadelphia had a two-year degree, but rolled it back, because they were having so few candidates. The big problem in this country is really smart people at MJE, we don't want to become cops. Cops are very blue collar. cops, as you write about by Penny, I did an investigation. 1/5 of our nation's officers have military experience. A lot of them, their family was in military. You don't have people with graduate degrees. You don't have people who speak multiple languages. You don't have people who are social workers becoming cops. So it's a bigger question that, you know, even millennials and Gen Z need to ask, like, why don't we want to become cops? Like, could we make it better? Question mark. I think this is a great model, but it's very hard to have a Harvard-educated person or someone with a law degree who's wanted by Google or could become a federal prosecutor to become a cop. It's still like a blue-collar job.
Agreed. Okay, good.
So I have an interesting kind of perspective on that because I think in some of the New York suburbs where I was a police commissioner, it's part of my councilwoman job.
You were a police commissioner? I don't know. We have a police commissioner on the class.
That's very cool. And I like see that because one of the issues in our community, which actually caused a separate issue, is that it's a very high paid job. There are great benefits. And so we were getting a lot of lawyers, accountants, like, you know, high level people with advanced degrees. So that the testing, like the police test, you get a couple of extra points if you're a veteran. But otherwise, the scores in the police test, we were only hiring people over 95. And so our police department was not very diverse, because we were only hiring people over 95. So there are, like, I think there are, you know, it's an interesting issue because I think Simone's right. One of the, what I was going to say before is that I think the biggest challenge is a lack of training, right? And I think that's something that's, like, coming out in the last few weeks, is that there doesn't seem to be standardized training, even amongst state departments, police departments, but for sure not nationally. And I know lots of people think that this should be, you know, states' rights versus federal, all these kinds of things. But if we don't train police officers, and if we're expecting more police officers, right, which I think the whole community policing model is, we are expecting police officers to do more than just police, you know, traditionally police their neighborhood, then we need to train them in sensitivities that might come across, and a whole bunch of other things, and not just assume because they can, you know, do a 16-week or 3-month course and, you know, shoot a gun, that they're ready to be a police officer.
And that requires funding, that kind of training.
Yeah.
And the defunding thing is so... the stupidity
of the defunding thing,
because it is all about really just...
Well, we call it reimagining for smarter people in the room. We don't call it defunding. We don't like that.
Well, reform, that's fine.
No,
but defunding is what we're going to call TaskRabbit.
No, we're calling it.
That's fine, yes, as it should be.
That's what the academics call it. The academic term. Reimagining.
Reimagining.
But yes, that people don't know that. So Stephanie's right, that there is no national standard. There's also no very few states. Washington State, one of the few states that has a standardized training program. New York, we are not one of those states.
Wow.
New York is also not one of the states where you get a police license. In New York, my hairdresser has a license. My cop doesn't. Boom. That's
crazy.
All right.
And I just want to make one comment on lawful but awful. You know, I've been working on some of these cases since I got here. I was working with a judge in the city part, all the cases where people said the city of New York, that's what we heard. And there were a lot of police cases. And there are a lot of cases that, like, they never won, where there were civil cases, you know, brought for, like, use of force cases and all of these things. And, like, the cases that we see make the headlines are the worst cases. There are so many times when, like, you know, you can detain someone for 24 hours without formally charging them.
Right.
You know, and that's a very humiliating and traumatic thing to go through. And people do bring lawsuits. And, like, they're, you know, they're worthless because it's such a high threshold. You'll never... The immunity for the police, which I agree there should be some immunity, some, really some, emphasis on some, but the threshold to sue civilly when you were arrested is so high. Like, I've only ever seen one case where, you know, they got, the people got money for suing in the civil courts.
Wow.
It's like, this is just what we see. So I agree, like, sensitivity training, that, you know, it's not just about, police using unlawful force that, you know, results in, unfortunately, in a death. There's so many cases where people are, you know, detained in their homes, and they won't let people get dressed. Like, it's just very humiliating things to go through. And I don't know, anyone in this class, maybe, if you've ever been pulled over by a cop, even though you didn't do anything wrong, or, like, maybe you were speeding, you know that fear.
Yes.
You know, so imagine being a person, you know, of color in this country. It's really scary. It's the he said, she said, where the he said was believed for so long. So it's very frightening. So I agree. More, maybe, definitely don't defund, but yes, there has to be a reimagine.
So, all right. So we're just to conclude, just to put everything in a look. So, first of all, I'm very encouraged that I didn't even know that in our small MGE senior fellowship class that we have so many people involved in the reporting and we had a police commissioner, we had a parole officer, we have a lawyer who deals with lawsuits against all kinds of unlawful things done. In the city of New York, including issues of law enforcement, and so first of all, I think we had a good, you know, we had our own morning talk show over here, but again, just to bring back some of the concepts that the Torah shares with us is that basically this is intrinsic. There's an intrinsic problem. There's a need where you do need a police. Where they have to discharge force responsibly, but the Torah did not trust a police officer to act, even with training. It's just not. They just sort of gave up on that, and rather to put the other guy in the patrol car as basically being literally one of the respected minds of the community. Obviously, they had to take turns, whatever, and that way to ensure that situations did not escalate. A, people are treated with dignity. Let's say you're the police officer and you're with the equivalent of Rabbi Soloveitchik in the car. You're not going to be beating people up. You know what I'm saying? You're going to be acting. And not only that, if you're walking with the rabbi through in a situation and everybody who's a member of the Jewish community, and you may not have gone to a shir, you know, but you know that he's a rabbi. So also you're going to relate to him differently. So intrinsically, it's bringing the situation down, de-escalation, rational thought, consideration. It's built in it. Again, what I didn't obviously to deal with all these issues. These are one variable. The police issue is dealing with a symptom. We did not deal with the issue of poverty and all the issues of the challenges that all people of color in America face. All kinds of factors that weave together to cause these problems. It's not. In other words, the problem was not only in the parking lot at the Wendy's. There's a problem which has many factors, but that's why the Torah you solve the problem not only by the immediate officer either discharging his weapon or not discharging his weapon. The issue comes back from a broader point where the ethic of the community is an ethic of dignity. Where justice is a virtue. Not only do you talk about it, but you learn about it. You learn, you know, a Jew is an educated Jew. He learns about it every day. He learns a chumash, a this, a parsha, whatever, to become educated. Because the best defense of not involved in crime is that you yourself don't choose any aspect of crime, a crimeful or behavior, because you want to live a good life. And the people who are in charge of the system are people who you look up to. Not as Simone says, blue-collar workers who you may, because of class issues, actually look down upon. You know what I'm saying? So it's a difficult situation. The Torah had a different take people are unaware of this perspective. I wanted to at least share that. And I felt that our conversation tonight was just incredibly interesting because we got stuff that's not available on the typical media location. So I want to thank everybody for a great conversation. And any questions?
Can I ask one more question for the panel, if people don't mind?
Hey, go ahead. Who's that, by the way?
Oh, it's Jonathan. Hi.
Hey, Jonathan, how are you?
I just couldn't get it.
No problem. We're happy to have you. John, by the way, Jonathan, also a lawyer. Let's go ahead.
Thank you. What's that?
You're a lawyer. We're just, you know, part of the judicial. Go ahead.
Maybe like in particular, Daphne and Simone. What have you run into the issue of, you know, have you had any impact of like the police union being a challenge or? To trying to get reforms in police tactics in your experiences?
Of course. So in New York, this last week we repealed 50A, which is a disciplinary. It was a law that prevented people like me, like journalists, lawyers, from getting any documents about a cop's disciplinary on record for years. It's been in court for years. And because of the George Floyd case, legislators passed. Cuomo signed it. Today it was announced. All the NYPD going back. All the body cam footage. All the disciplinary stuff. We online. Someone like me, this is like Hanukkah. I didn't want to say Christmas in July. I'm not Christian. This is great news.
We're losing our Simone.
It's in New York, but it's any city that I want to know what's happening, the political climate, straight time. Not the feds passing law so we can get access to basic information. I want to know if a cop has a use of force complaint. Why can't I know that, right? We know if our doctor was ever cited. Why can't we know if our local cop was cited? Like, what's the big deal? It was blocked for years because of the police.
Yeah, 58 was a major.
But I am to transparency. All right, so I don't know if everybody heard Simone. Yeah, she just said
I'm
that
so
they. Because Simone, you fade a little bit, but just I just want to make sure everybody heard that a major piece of legislation in New York. I didn't hear the first part. 58, item 58 was passed, which allows to go back and investigate any charges against any police officers, going back any citations or anything. Is now available for lawyers and as well as journalists. All right, that's great. So this is all right, guys. So this is any other question before we wrap it up?
What's the difference? I know 50A is the. What's the other thing? The immunity thing, the police immunity thing.
Qualified immunity.
Yeah.
What's that?
So that's like a whole thing. So like not just cops, and it makes sense. From some point, it does make sense. Like, so how are you going to be a cop or a firefighter? Or a paramedic in New York, if you could be personally sued. Let's say you're a paramedic, you didn't take someone to the hospital, and they died later because, you know, they didn't want to go, and then they died later that night. You are exposing yourself to personal liability. There should be some level of immunity. You're a firefighter, you destroy someone's apartment in order to fight a fire in another apartment. Are you going to be sued for destroying the apartment? No. You know, there has to be some protection if you're doing your job. Otherwise, no one's going to do their job. But things like 50A are like over, like they're it's almost like I understand it started as a kind of immunity, but it's now just not in the interest of what it was meant to be in the first place anymore because it ends up protecting bad people and that's not good. On the other hand, it's like you don't want like the complaint system to be abused. Like right now, like the first video we saw, again, it's a picture that it's three white women would be even be talking about it. Probably not. You don't want it to sway in the other direction. And now, because of the political climate, you have a lot of, like, you know, people abusing the system and cops, good cops getting fired when they shouldn't. I mean, it's almost, like, going to happen anyway. It's kind of sad that there's going to be some victims in all this, like good cops being fired because of the political climate. But that's, I don't know, maybe society has its weird way of, like, balancing out. But so it was meant to, you know, there is a qualified immunity. Otherwise, also, New York would be bankrupt. We get so many lawsuits. We're sued for everything. And they settle. A lot of them just settle, even though, because they don't want to go to trial. So, like, New York would be bankrupt. But that's the whole purpose of immunity. Like, qualified
but
immunity.
There are,
prosecutors have it, too. Prosecutors have it as well.
But there are also, I think, there are a lot of protections for the
of state, and even line of duty injury type things that go on for years and years and years,
yeah.
And protections of the police union that, you know, if there was real reform or reimagining, then it would be better for, you know, maybe not. It would be better probably for everyone involved, maybe the, like, you know, people who are not, using the system properly or taking advantage of the system, it wouldn't be. But for everyone else,
it will. Excellent. Any other questions, comments last time before we call tonight? All right, so I want to thank everybody. It was a great conversation and good senior fellowship and good stuff. And I want to thank everybody, and especially Simone, who brought a wealth of experience and insider information to the class, as well as Daphne and Stephanie and everybody. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Hold on, Scott. Hold on, Scott. Oh, yeah, hold on. Yeah, hold on. Whoa, hold on. What's that, guys? Just you should know, tomorrow night is Shuki's L'chaim. If you don't have, I'm going to send out information for that to say goodbye. Yeah, Scott, you had a question?
No. I was just going to say, Simone was on a very popular podcast, Today Explained. She made some really good points about, you know, police reform.
Okay, so
highly recommend it.
So could you, Scott, can you post it? Can you post it on our WhatsApp group so we can all enjoy that?
But she needs to call me back.
Okay, all right, we're getting too personal here. Okay.
I'll text you after.
Send it to the group, guys. Have a good night. All the best. Bye.
Bye.